Hi everyone, my name is John Erickson, and I am the kernel test lead for Windows Serviceability at Microsoft. And I've been working with Madan, Sebastian, and Kirk on this project. They're from Microsoft Research, and I'm kind of honored and humbled to be able to share with you some of the research we've been doing with regard to finding data races. So we'll just go ahead and jump right in and look at a data race that's particularly near and dear to my heart. This is the first data race I found with the tool. And what we have is we have one bit that's getting ANDed out by thread A and another bit that's getting ORed in by thread B. And these memory accesses can line up in a certain way so that either thread A's operation or thread B's operation can get effectively swallowed or overwritten by the other. And this resulted in a system hang, and this is an actual bug that was fixed for Windows 7 post release. So if you're not as familiar with data races, here's an unoptimized assembly of that previous slide. And so what we can see is happening, or could happen, is one of the threads will read in the value from memory to the local register, apply some modification to it, and then some sort of context switch can happen, something that would delay that first thread, and that can be, you know, another thread of higher priority getting released or a device interrupt or things like that. Now, with thread A being delayed, thread B can come along, and it's going to read the old value from memory. It's kind of a stale value. It's going to provide, it's going to modify that stale value and write it out to memory. Now, the problem arises is when the other thread comes back and writes its modified value out to memory. And what happens is the flag that we tried to set in thread B basically disappears, like it was never there. And that's how the hang ended up happening. So that was sort of a super unoptimized assembly. The compiler is more likely to emit something like this. And the important thing to remember is I didn't learn it this way in school, but instructions aren't really atomic. They might be atomic from a, you can't get an interrupt during the middle of an instruction, but when you have these read-write instructions, their memory accesses are not atomic. And so you can get the same interleavings going on even with two single instructions. So now that we've seen a little example, I was going to talk about what exactly I mean when I'm talking about a data race. So the key thing is you just have two memory accesses. They're occurring from different threads. They can happen at the same time. And they're touching the same underlying physical memory. And of course, one of them has to be modifying the memory. If you can have multiple threads both reading the memory, and there's no sort of conflict involved there. And so hopefully, you know, the gravity of these bugs can be sort of inferred from that first bug. And so as from the test perspective, it's very hard to reproduce these bugs. In that example, we had to have two separate cores on a system running those instructions at the same time. And so the timings are extremely, extremely tight. And so it's hard to reproduce. And the scary thing about that one is it's really, really hard to correctly identify it. So if you go back and look at the logs, we're going to see that, hey, we called this function to set this bit. But a second later, the bit's not set. And it's all too easy just to write that off as some sort of hardware bit flip. And that's something that we see a lot. So the other thing I want to mention is sort of the trend I see. I thought it was just at Microsoft. But from the first presentation, people are moving scalability is becoming more important. So they're taking these monolithic locks and breaking them down into fine-grained locks and lock-free. And that's good for performance, but it's bad for testing. And it just introduces more places where data races can occur. So if we look at some of the previous techniques that have been applied to finding data races, the two main approaches have been happens before and lock-set. And both of them suffer a pretty significant overhead. Example, Intel Thread Checker runs at about 200x. And so the root cause of this overhead is that these algorithms require that you have to log all synchronization accesses, and that you also need to log any memory accesses that you might want to consider as a possible data race. So all of this instrumentation is very heavy, and it what ends up happening is when you have overheads on this level, it makes it really infeasible to apply to existing test infrastructures. So the if I told my boss, hey, I can find bugs in the kernel if you let me run the test for 200 times longer than normal, he would think that would be wonderful. He'd say, hey, that's great, I'll give you the machine time, no problem. The problem we run into is you have all sorts of test infrastructure failures. The kernel will bug check on boot if it doesn't get the boot device enumerated quickly enough. The test servers will, think that the test machine has failed if they haven't, pinged to the server with a heartbeat. So these overhead numbers are actually really important when it comes to deploying. So in addition to overhead, there's this other challenge, which is, for happens before in lockset, since you have to log all synchronization accesses, that also implies you have to know about all of them exhaustively. So any way that one thread can block another thread needs to be defined and understood by the tool if you don't want to report false data races. And when we started looking at how do we apply this to the kernel and kernel mode components where there's homegrown locking and interrupts and DPCs and all sorts of asynchronous things and even interactions between a device driver and the hardware itself where there's some sort of contract between those two, it sort of became a pretty difficult problem, as you can see by the character. So what do we want to accomplish here? And so the primary thing we decided was no false data races. And I'll explain exactly what I mean by that in a second. But if we have to take a design decision to decide do we want to find more data races but have some of them be false and not existent, or do we want to find less data races but be certain that these are actual data races that are occurring, we're going to take the latter approach. And so to clarify, when I'm saying false, I mean a data race that doesn't actually occur. And so in a little example, you have this two threads and they're both incrementing a reference count, but they're protected by a locking mechanism. Now, that's not a data race, assuming the locking mechanism works. However, with some of the prior techniques, if you don't describe that locking mechanism to the tool, it would report that as a data race, even though it couldn't occur. That's in contrast with a benign data race. So a benign data race does occur, and we'll see they occur kind of frequently. But they're either intentionally put there by the developer, or they don't have ill effects. So in that same scenario, we can see some statistics counters is a motif we see where if your network card reports that it pumped out 5 million bits in the last second as opposed to 5 million in one, it's not a bug really. No one's going to fix that. But the thing that, and in fact, they probably would intentionally do it this way. If you remember back in the first talk, we were talking about interlocked instructions being more expensive. And people will use uninterlocked operations like this as sacrificing exact values for speed. So besides no false data races, the second goal was user-controlled overhead. If we really want to be able to deploy these to different scenarios and test environments, we need to give the user full control of how much overhead there is. Now, obviously, there's going to be some sort of trade-off between how many data races you might find and how much overhead you incur, but we want to give that tuning knob to the user to control. And finally, we want to be able to make sure that when we do find a data race that we're really getting together actionable data and debuggable context so that this can go in a bug report and later be handed off to some other developer, grabs it from his bug queue, and he's going to be able to jump right in and understand what's going on. So with these goals in mind, what are the insights we had? Now, the first one is, and happens before in lockset, you're trying to infer when a data race might have occurred under some different thread interleaving. Instead of trying to do that, let's just try and cause it to actually happen. And that sort of remove our dependency on having a full understanding of all the locking mechanisms. And as we'll see later, it will also help us with debugging information. And the other insight is we want to sample these memory accesses. But we want to do so in a way, because we want to be able to control our overhead effectively, where there's not a base overhead. So previous models, we used a binary instrumentation tool, but then we moved. We had this insight to move to code breakpoints. And I'll show you how, you know, without binary instrumentation, we can use these code breakpoints to sample. So the one way to just describe this is to look at a little intersection metaphor. And so you think of the intersection as a memory location. And one thread is coming along, and this memory location is protected by a lock. So thread A, the car, has the lock, so he's cruising along. Now this is where this sort of sampling can come in. So we can control whether, you know, a particular memory access is the original instruction or if it has a software code breakpoint set in there. So when there's no code breakpoint set, we're just running the original instruction stream. If this instruction is being sampled, there is a code breakpoint. And what happens is Data Collider will step in and delay that thread. Now, we've hooked the trap handler, so, got ahead of myself. We hooked the trap handler, so we are in control of the thread at that moment in time. Data Collider can then set a data breakpoint on that memory location. And then we'll just wait. Now, in the normal case, we're going to wait. Some other thread might come along. And this is a well-behaved thread. It's going to try and, you know, follow the proper locking semantics before accessing this memory location. And since it does so, it doesn't matter how long we wait, thread B won't access that memory location. So we can, after some amount of time, we can remove the data breakpoint and let thread A continue execution. Now in the case where there is a data race, you rewind in your head a little bit, where had the data breakpoint set and we're delaying, some other thread comes along, and this is a bad thread. It's not following the locking semantics, and it's just going to go ahead and access that memory location. And so, of course, when it does, it hits the trap. We've hooked the trap handler, and now this is sort of the important part when it comes to debugging. So the cool thing about this scenario is we have both threads paused in the state of an exact data race, full stack, full register set. You know, you have the global state. So this is really the information that we can log that we can hand off to a developer later on, and like they can really be up to speed on it very quickly. We clear out the data breakpoint and resume execution. So now that you've seen a comical representation, let's dig into the details a little bit more of how we implemented this. So the basic process is you take a binary, you want to analyze. And you use the public symbols and disassembly to enumerate the instructions in that binary that access memory. Then once you've hooked the breakpoint handler, you can start to sprinkle, like randomly, code breakpoints on those memory access instructions. And so this is where the overhead comes in. So if we set 0% of the memory accesses as code breakpoints, we're by definition basically running at zero overhead because we're running 100% the bit-for-bit original instruction stream. And the user can tune, you know, what percentage of memory addresses, memory instructions, to set as code breakpoints to control the overhead. Now, when we do hit a code breakpoint, what happens is we disassemble the instruction. And since we have control of the thread and its context, we can calculate the memory address that it was trying to access. Now, once we do that, we can set the data breakpoint and, you know, the trap is set, we can just wait. Now, if you look closely here, there's a read before the delay and a read after the delay. Now, when we're looking at kernel mode stuff, you run into DMA and multiple virtual to physical mappings. And we would see data collisions, data races that would occur between, you know, one thread accessing a physical address via one virtual address, another thread accessing the same physical address through a different virtual address. And since on x86, data breakpoints work on virtual addresses, we implemented this read again strategy as a sort of a fallback. So what were the results we got from this? So this is just Windows 7, a couple of the subsystems of the kernel analyzed along with some of the more common drivers. 113 data races on just a booting to the desktop. So the interesting thing is the vast majority are benign. There's lots of races are occurring, and it's okay. And so this is sort of like, for us, our research is the tip of the iceberg, and how do we separate the benign from the non-benign? And just from this small initial sampling, we can start to see a couple of trends, like with statistic counters I mentioned earlier. Say flag updates is when we have one thread that's writing to a bit, another flag that's reading from a different bit, so there's no conflict between them. Special variables are things like tick count, which are they're naturally changing, I guess you could say. So there's some good research to be done in this area on how do we separate these benign races from the real issues we want to fix and solve. So through the different iterations and prototypes of Data Collider, we amassed 25 different bugs in Windows OS that are either been fixed or will be fixed in the next release. And there's 8 more that are still under investigation. I wanted to pull out a couple of these as interesting case studies. So this one I'd originally thought was a bug in my implementation because it's accessing two different memory variables. But when you look at the disassembly, you see they're accessing the same byte, just different bits. And sure enough, when you look at the structure definition, these fields are actually bit fields. And the way they're set up in the structure is these bit fields actually lie on the same byte of physical memory. So what happens is, the funny thing is, thread A holds a lock that protects the initialized value, and thread B holds a lock that protects the queued for closing value. The only problem is the resource under contention is that physical byte, and neither has exclusive access to it, so the data race can still happen. Case study 3 is two threads. They both think they own the lock. Only one of them does. And so we found this by taking a PNP stress scenario applying Data Collider to the driver that was being stressed. And we found that through some error cases, there were some places where we called the state machine update function with acquire lock equal to false, implying that we already own the lock when it should be true, because we do not. So this is one of the this is the important graph for the presentation, the scalability overhead. So things to note is we can get the overhead down to zero. If there's no breakpoint set, and then we can start to find data races even at 5% overhead, and it's noisy because we're randomly selecting breakpoints, but you can control how many data races you find by controlling how much overhead you want to induce. And so I mentioned some future work already about how do we prioritize how benign or not benign a particular data race might be. We have some hypotheses about, do data races that occur more frequently, are they more likely to be benign because we'd be seeing errors about them already if they weren't? So there's some unanswered questions in that area. And what can we do to apply this algorithm to maybe some of the performance issues that we saw in the first talk? Data sharing is, an issue, and then you can sort of think as false data sharing where you're touching the same cache line unintentionally, and that you can think of that as a near miss, sort of. So the demo is a little bit of a trick, so I apologize, because This presentation has been run in a VM that is running Data Collider on the NTFS and NDIS drivers. And so I'll pin that. We're going to go ahead and collect the log and see what we caught this time. So during the presentation, we were averaging 1,026 code breakpoints per second. And we found 138 different entries. And I don't think I'm legally allowed to tell you what all these different things mean. Exactly. How do I bring that? Let me just go to the last slide over here. So in summary, Data Collider can detect races. It can do so without detecting false data races. It can scale down to an overhead of zero, and it works in kernel mode, and it finds real product bugs. And like many of the other companies you have heard today, we are hiring. Thank you.
People have questions? To warm things up a little bit, you showed us as future work trying to figure out whether races are benign or not, but can you comment a little bit on some preliminary thoughts you might have, or you know, how do you go about it?
So,
and how much pain it is in a real product?
So the pain is you know, me having to sit down and go through 113 databases and diagnose them by grepping the source code. These are the major categories we saw, and some of them are going to be easier to detect, and some of them, like if you remember that early slide with this is the problem with animations. Okay. You know, if you would look at the disassembly of this, they're just increment instructions and trying to convey some sort of global significance of them, it becomes very difficult. Like even with a statistics counter, what if that statistics counter is something for the process quota, like how many files a particular user can have open? So there's a lot of unanswered questions there, I guess.
Yeah, Rick Farrow. I was just a little curious. You said that you're randomly setting breakpoints, but you keep dropping hints that it's not really random. For example, the example you're running right now, you've actually put breakpoints in two particular device, like a device driver. You said NTFS for one. So it's not totally random that you're doing here.
So the demo was I had the NDIS driver and the NTFS driver.
Yes.
And so for those two drivers, all the memory accesses were enumerated. And then from those, they were randomly sampled.
Okay. So you had a starting point, and then you can enumerate what the memory accesses are going to be, and then that's how you set the breakpoints.
We set the breakpoints without knowing what they will be, but just it's a feedback loop. Kind of, we say we want to have this many code breakpoints happening per second,
right?
And then we change the percentages we have set up and down to reach that.
Yeah, I got that point. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm Micah Brodsky from MIT. So you mentioned needing to use debug symbols to actually perform the instrumentation. I was curious how dependent the technique is on having full debug symbols. In the sense that I suspect that, like most bugs in kernel mode, third-party device drivers harbor the bulk of the problems. And it might be interesting if you could make this sort of tool available with the kind of tools like are already available not just to developers but also to administrators to go and point the fingers at their vendors for like driver verifier, which probably most people don't know, is this test harness that ships with Windows. It's in every Windows box. You can run this test harness on drivers, and out of the box, machines very typically will come with failures in this just completely absolute bugs dug up by this test harness. I'm wondering whether these sort of techniques could be applied in that sort of scenario where third-party device driver offers are much more secretive than even Microsoft is about the structure of their binaries.
So the dependence on symbols is so we know where the memory access instructions are. You can load the module into memory, and then if you have some other technique of being able to enumerate all those instructions.
So you could do a heuristic disassembly alignment type.
Yeah, so the problem, we tried to do it without symbols, and we'd end up accidentally putting a breakpoint into data, and that would cause problems.
Thanks.
Peter Druschel, MPI SWS. I enjoyed your talk. It's a really clever technique. I'm wondering, you showed some data that shows how sampling rate and overhead is related to the number of races you found. What I didn't get was how the sampling rate and thereby the overhead would be related to the expected time until you detect a particular race. I'm wondering, did you try to perhaps inject a certain, a given number of known races and then try different sampling rates to figure out how long would it take to detect these?
No, we haven't. There's one thing we'd like to verify is we want to make sure that we're not just getting all the easy races.
Sure.
That, even at these low overheads, we want to make sure, that these, if we're getting 20 data races, it's a uniform sampling of all the data races that are, and it's not just the 20 easiest ones.
Sure.
But we haven't found any other data race detectors that work in the kernel, so we don't have a good comparison point yet.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, we're staying on time. This is amazing. Thank you.